This is Everything Financial Radio. I'm your host, Dennis Tuberg, and we are here every week at this time. Welcome. I have joining me momentarily on today's show from Cornell University Department of Government, Professor Jonathan Kirshner. Professor Kirshner is the author of the book, American Power After the Financial Crisis, and we'll be talking to him about whether or not there is a high likelihood, in his view, for another financial crisis as well as other economic issues. Also on today's program, I'm going to be covering a topic that I think is one of the most important topics for folks to understand in this environment. And certainly it's an important perspective, I think, that you'll want to get. And that whole topic is the idea of managing retirement assets using a one-bucket approach versus a two-bucket approach. As I'll explain on today's program, many in the financial industry who frankly don't have a good background when it comes to economics and macroeconomics, in my opinion, are taking a one-bucket approach. And it's my belief, and I'll share with you why I believe this, that the one-bucket approach being used today by many folks to manage their nest eggs may fail. I will be giving you an alternative to consider, as well as some details, something called a two-bucket approach, which I believe is based in common sense, and I'd encourage you to listen in. Maybe even get a piece of paper and a pen, and if you know somebody that's getting close to retirement, give them a call and tell them we're on the air now talking about an alternative perspective to managing retirement assets, something called the two-bucket approach. So I'd encourage you to stay tuned for the entire program today, and I will be covering that topic in detail. We also cover that in detail at our new retirement rules class. If you'd like more information about our class coming up on April the 25th, just visit newretirementrules.com. We have a one-day class coming up on that day held downtown Grand Rapids at Western Michigan University. All the details are posted at newretirementrules.com. I'm pleased to have as a first-time guest on Everything Financial Radio, Mr. Jonathan Kirshner. Jonathan is the author of American Power After the Financial Crisis. He is also the professor or a professor of international political economy in the Department of Government at Cornell. And Professor Kirshner, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's just start, Jonathan, talking about your book, American Power After the Financial Crisis. Give us some of the main premises in the book and what motivated you to write it.
Sure. Well, let me take the second part first because I think it's clarifying. I'm a professor of international relations, and my area of specializations, or my areas of specialization, are both the politics of international money and finance, but also the relationship between economics and power, or economics and war, or the economics and national security is what we call it. So not surprisingly, when the financial crisis occurred, what was very interesting to me, given my particular areas of interest, were the consequences of that crisis for larger questions of international relations. So we have like shelves full of books, and some of them very good, on the financial crisis itself and on its economics, and I have to engage some of those topics, of course. But where I enter this discussion is about how the financial crisis is understood as international politics. And in that sense, it's very interesting, I argue, for two reasons in particular, that it had both effects on the material real world, that is, it accelerated underlying trends that were already in existence about the relative decline of U.S. power and influence, but it also had an ideational effect. It affected ideas, the way people think about the way the world is organized, that pretty much up until the crisis, the American financial model was seen as the kind of singularly correct financial model that everybody sort of had to converge to. And after the financial crisis, I think that many in the world had greater skepticism about that model, and therefore what we're seeing is greater experimentation with different forms of financial organization and a little more pushback at some of the American styles of international governance. And so for a student of international politics, these material changes and these changes about the way people think about the world matter for world politics.
Well, Jonathan, let me just, for our listeners maybe that don't understand or aren't clear about the underlying causes of the financial crisis, maybe provide the listeners with a basic 101 explanation and, given your area of expertise, maybe incorporate how politics maybe were involved in the financial crisis.
Sure. there are different perspectives on what caused the financial crisis. The perspective that I embrace is one associated with economists like Charles Kindleberger, and they say that financial crises are the consequence of essentially unregulated and unsupervised financial systems. That Kindleberger had this great phrase in which he said, most markets work well most of the time. And that is true, but it means that some markets don't work well all of the time, and some markets need a little bit of oversight. For example, we prefer our nuclear power industry to be regulated to make sure that the waste produced by the nuclear power industry is handled in a way that does not affect the public in a dangerous way. Similarly, finance, which is essential for an economy, and a thriving financial sector is an important part of an economy, also generates some dangers, most notably something called systemic risk. That is that individual financial actors can each take rational steps, but collectively they create an amount of risk in the system that can be dangerous and manifest itself in financial crises. And so from a Kindleberger point of view, a financial system needs to be kind of supervised and regulated. But from the 80s and into the early 1990s, the U.S. embraced a view that we could peel back our regulation and oversight of the financial system. And for a Kindlebergian like myself, the natural consequence of that was that a financial crisis was likely to occur at some point. And really the debate that is taking place writ large is whether financial crises are naturally occurring phenomenon as a result of unregulated financial systems. Now, I think that Kindleberger and many others have shown that history is very clear about this. They are. In the U.S., because of some very, very exceptional aspects of the U.S. economy, U.S. predominance, U.S. hegemony, the massive size of the U.S. economy, the fact that it was the world's financial center, the fact that it issued the dollar, we were sort of immune to this phenomenon that affected the entire world over and over again. And so for us, the crisis seems like the legendary black swan. But for most of the rest of the world, the crisis seems like a garden variety international financial crisis that they've experienced over and over again. And that's why I think there's a lot of new thinking around the world about that crisis. So the bumper sticker is, deregulated finance will cause crises. And that would be the fundamental roots of the crisis. We could point to different decision points, and I'd be happy to point to them as well, but the general bumper sticker has to do with financial deregulation.
Well, if you're just joining us, we are chatting today with Jonathan Kirshner, who is the author of American Power After the Financial Crisis. And Jonathan, just about two and a half minutes left in this segment. I have had guests on the program who would argue, maybe contrary to the view you just expressed, that one of the causes of the financial crisis was too much government involvement in the financial system. And case in point, regulations that required or encouraged banks to make loans to subprime borrowers, so that by 2007, I think it was 3 out of 4 mortgages in the United States were subprime. That would be kind of a contrary opinion to the one you just expressed. How would you respond to someone offering that perspective?
I do think, with respect to serious people who have made arguments like that, that it is kind of a after-the-fact politicized argument. If you look at some of the crucial decisions that were being made in the financial sector, the Commodities Futures Modernization Act in the late 1990s, which meant that the U.S. government could not oversee and supervise derivatives. And when you look at the number of open contracts that an outfit like Bear Stearns had when it was on the brink of bankruptcy, the interconnectedness of all these institutions, the subprime mortgage crisis we knew about before the global financial crisis, and you could even make an argument that it contributed to the trigger of it. But when Ben Bernanke goes before Congress and says correctly that 12 of the 13 largest financial institutions in the United States were on the brink of bankruptcy at one moment in that week, it was not because the government urged banks to lend to make subprime loans. It was because of the metastasized systemic risk in which these unsupervised, unregulated derivatives transactions meant that what were supposed to be super savvy financial actors didn't even know the value of the assets that they were holding. And that's why the system froze up. So I just don't find that argument credible.
Well, we are chatting today with Professor Jonathan Kirshner, author of American Power After the Financial Crisis, and we will continue our conversation with him when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in today. I'll be continuing my conversation with Mr. Jonathan Kirshner in the next segment. Now, I want to talk a bit about an approach that we ask folks to consider when it comes to managing their nest egg, and we call it simply the two-bucket approach. In fact, we talk about this in detail during some of our educational functions and in our educational resources. Now, if you've been a long-time listener to Everything Financial Radio, you know that we believe that there's something called a money currency cycle that exists, and these money currency cycles lead to economic cycles. And when you look at these economic cycles, one of the factors that contributes to these economic cycles or changing economic conditions is the level of private sector debt that exists in the economy. If you take a look at what happened back in the 1920s, a period of time known as the Roaring Twenties, private sector debt levels behind the scenes were building to unsustainable levels. And once they reached the point, once debt levels in the system reached the point that the system couldn't handle any more debt or service any more debt, then the economic conditions changed from one of prosperity to one of deflation. Now, we believe that given today's private sector debt levels are high, in fact, today private sector debt levels, when measured as a percentage of the economy, they're 50% larger than in 1929 at the beginning of the Great Depression. So we believe that at some point we will see deflation. The question is, are we going to see inflation or hyperinflation first because of monetary policy? In either scenario, whether we have deflation or inflation followed by deflation, we believe using a traditional one-bucket approach to managing finances will, again, in our view, lead to certain failure. In an economic winter environment, the traditional asset classes folks use, which are stocks and bonds, if you have a 401k, you probably have a few different investment options, stocks, bonds, and cash, but that's typically in many plans. That's not true of all plans. But in an economic winter environment, if you're using this one-bucket approach and you've got only stocks and bonds in your portfolio, during this economic winter environment, we believe that both stocks and bonds can decline. Now, in a winter environment, we believe using a two-bucket approach may make a lot more sense. Now, there are five goals to the two-bucket approach. Now, I should point out that because something has happened in the past doesn't mean it's going to happen again in the future. And just because you have a goal, there's no guarantee that these goals will actually be attained. But here are the five goals that the two-bucket approach embraces. One, reduce fees associated with investments. We find a lot of folks don't know what they're paying in internal fees in maybe mutual funds, management fees to an advisory company or brokerage. And while fees many times are unavoidable and necessary, the question is, what are you paying? What are you paying in fees, and what are you getting? What are you getting in benefits? So the two-bucket approach has goal number one, reduce fees associated with investments. Goal number two, limit or eliminate investment drawdown during a deflationary environment. Three, hedge for the possibility of inflation or even hyperinflation should central banks around the world decide to continue to print money at a very high pace. Four, hedge for the possibility of a future fiat currency failure. We know historically speaking, fiat currencies have a 100% failure rate. And goal number five, achieve positive returns each year. See, we believe the two-bucket approach is a simple, logical way to manage assets. While there's no perfect approach to managing assets, we believe the two-bucket approach is by far the superior method for an economic winter environment such as the one in which we find ourselves today. Now, we developed this two-bucket approach to managing assets over several years after observing how many of the stockbrokers that gave advice and used a one-bucket approach, we saw how that advice failed many clients back in the 2001 correction. Then again, after the stock market correction of 2008, we saw many clients whose retirement hopes and dreams had been shattered after they followed the traditional one-bucket counsel offered by many conventionally trained financial professionals. Now, to be fair, the two-bucket approach is not without its trade-offs. In a one-bucket approach, as we've mentioned, an investor typically has only two primary asset classes in his or her portfolio: stocks and bonds, or more typically, stock funds and bond funds. Now, this can be good, or it can be bad. Common sense will tell you the fewer assets in a portfolio, the greater the probability of a terrific year as far as returns are concerned. But it has, because there are fewer asset classes in a one-bucket approach, it does have the potential to outperform the two-bucket approach if stocks happen to have a great year. But in a bad year for stocks, the one-bucket approach can have an investor experiencing significantly negative returns and even have his or her nest egg devastated. This is when the one-bucket approach can fail. The one-bucket approach, comprising just stocks and bonds, or just stock funds and bond funds, would have seen, if one looks at the returns of the S&P 500 from 2000 through 2013, would have seen the portfolio decline by as much as 43.1% or 37% on a calendar year basis. And on the other hand, this portion of the portfolio could have risen on a calendar year basis by as much as 60 or 90%. So big losses and big returns tend to be typical of the one-bucket approach to managing money. If the one-bucket approach to managing assets had a personality, it might be described as being bipolar. Advocates of the one-bucket approach point to the big return years as reasons to use this approach. Many investors opting for the one-bucket approach to managing assets are hoping for these big returns, but often, when they look a little closer at their own individual facts and circumstances, their own individual situation, they're often taking too much risk for their individual circumstances. Many of these investors would be better served to seek more consistent, steady returns. To make my point, just consider this question with me for a moment. Over a four-year time frame, would you rather have an average annual yield of 25% on your portfolio, or would you prefer a consistent return of 4% per year? Again, here's the question. Would you rather have an average annual yield of 25% on your portfolio, or would you rather have a consistent return of 4% per year? My guess is, as you listen to me pose that question to you, you likely answered by saying you'd take the 25% average annual yield. In fact, if you answered the question that way, you answered the question as most folks would have. But if you answered the question that way, you may have answered too hastily. Let me give you a couple examples and possibilities. If you have $100,000 in your investment account and you get a 4% return each year for 4 years, your account balance at the end of the fourth year is $116,986. Now let's assume you get a 25% average annual return as follows. Your year one return is a negative 50%. Your year two return is plus 100%. Your year three return is a negative 50%, and your year four return is a positive 100%. So over 4 years, you go negative 50%, plus 100, negative 50, plus 100. Your average annual return is 25%, but your net return is zero. The point is this: if your portfolio gets variable or fluctuating returns, the average annual return achieved is far less relevant than the actual net return achieved. Now, we talk about this one factor at our new retirement rules class, and as I close this segment, let me invite you to get more information, and let me invite you to go to the website newretirementrules.com so you can learn about this resource that we have. The resource is very affordable. It's just $49. The new retirement rules class is a one-day class. It begins at 9 a.m., concludes at 2:30 p.m., It's held on a Saturday, and the next class will be held on Saturday, April the 25th. It will be held at the downtown campus of Western Michigan University. Again, to get more information, visit newretirementrules.com. You can also register at that site while capacity remains. At the class, we talk about many different topics, including the one that I just discussed in this segment in great detail. So again, the website, newretirementrules.com. I'd encourage you to go check it out. I'll be back with Jonathan Kirshner after these words. Stay with us.
Give me your money.
Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have the pleasure of chatting today with first-time guest here on the program, Professor Jonathan Kirshner. The professor has written a book titled American Power After the Financial Crisis, and we have been chatting with him about the root causes of the financial crisis. And given, Jonathan, that you had really pointed out that one of the causes of the crisis was the massive amount of derivative exposure that these too big to fail banks had, and given that by at least some of the research I've done that derivative exposure really hasn't gone away in spite of some additional regulation. In fact, by some accounts, it's actually larger than it was prior to the financial crisis. What would be your prediction as to the future of the U.S. banking system? Are we going to see a repeat of what happened back in 2007, 2008?
Well, I'm wary of making point predictions, and I would also urge your listeners to be wary of those who would make them. But I would say the following, and it is ominous, but I think it is true, which is that the underlying causes of the global financial crisis of 2007-2008, in the United States at least, have not gone away. That we still have financial institutions that are too large, too interconnected, and take on or generate too much systemic risk, even in the light of the reforms that we have seen in the wake of the crisis. I think those reforms overall, while some of them are real, have been in aggregate fairly modest. And there are two interesting reasons for that, I think. One is that people complain about the way the government responded to the crisis, but in fact, we stood on the brink of another Great Depression. And government policy, however imperfect, flooding the system with liquidity and an early bout of countercyclical lending, prevented the Great Recession from becoming the Great Depression. We were kind of fortunate, however tragic that is to say, to have only experienced the Great Recession and not the Great Depression. But that inhibited fundamental reform of the banking sector. In the Great Depression, because it was so horrible, we did get fundamental reform of the banking sector. Here, we got marginal change at the edges. We also need to understand that our financial sector is enormously powerful, and they spent hundreds of millions of dollars lobbying Congress when those new regulations were being written. So obviously, if they're, you know, as smart as they think they are, those hundreds of millions of dollars were money well spent, and those were designed to protect their what they perceived to be their narrow business interests from the heavy hand of government, but which left the rest of us still vulnerable to the systemic risks that their activities generate. So while I would not predict a financial crisis, I would say that the U.S. financial economy remains vulnerable to the possibility of financial crisis, pretty much for the same reasons why it was vulnerable to financial crisis leading up to 2007-2008.
Well, Jonathan, let me get your take on monetary policy. You'd made a comment that one of the policy responses of the Fed was to flood the economy with liquidity or cash through the quantitative easing programs. Now you see that Europe has really engaged in a similar program. Japan has been printing at a maniacal pace for a long time. And worldwide, we seem to have this race to the bottom as far as currency devaluation is concerned. Give me your take on what the end game is. How does all this play out, and what are the political ramifications of this policy?
Sure. In the U.S., eventually these activities will be unwound. I'm not one of those who is terribly alarmed about the threat of high levels of inflation coming on the heels of this quantitative easing. I think it was necessary. It perhaps was overly necessary because of a bit of fiscal paralysis in other branches of our government, and so monetary policy perhaps was asked to do more than it really was designed to do. But the risks of deflation in the U.S., Japan, and Europe continue to outweigh the risks of inflation. And you know, given the history of the Fed, it is very doubtful that if and when inflation does appear to rear its head, the Fed will not take rather prompt measures to reel it in. And the Fed is well disposed to be able to do that. So I do think those emergency measures were absolutely necessary. I think that, you know, it's a simple counterfactual question. Had they not taken those measures, would the economy be worse off or better off? I think it would have been worse off. Does the Fed have the capacity to unwind these measures? Yes, it does. But if anything, in the U.S., there needs to be a bit of caution about reeling these measures in too quickly because, as you observed, in much of the rest of the world, there is various styles of quantitative easing going on, and we will continue to see things like dollar appreciation, things that will cut against the competitiveness of our products as we try and sell them abroad. And so it's a very complex question. I do not fret that we're on the cusp of a hyperinflation due to quantitative easing, but it is something that will have to be managed properly.
So, you know, we have listeners that are tuning into the program every week, and they're managing money in 401ks and IRAs. And when you say that the Fed does have the ability to unwind these measures, could you comment on, one, some potential ways that the Fed does unwind these measures? And then secondly, how might some of our listeners managing their nest eggs be affected?
Well, I don't want to get too much into the technicalities of this because it's really not something that I feel certain about, that is the specifics of them. So speaking to the latter question, and again, not being someone who has a crystal ball about where the stock market is going, I would make the observation that part of the contribution to the massive bull market we've seen in the past few years is that these emergency financial measures have left few alternatives for investors to turn to other than equities, other than the stock market. And that as monetary policy in the coming years is likely to normalize, then that might undercut the momentum behind the racing bull market. It is, you would not think that people need reminding, yet they do, that markets can go both up and down. And so I think that the standard advice that most people give to investors remains true all the time, which is to diversify, which is to not expect super normal profits, and to and be defended against possible problems that would emerge. And so if your portfolio is diverse, and if your expectations are reasonable, and if you're alert to the types of risks that might be lurking in the economy, then you should be okay. I mean, this is not my area of expertise, but the stock market in historical perspective looks kind of high. I mean, that ought to be something that people calculate when they're thinking about equities. The problem is that bond yields are so tremendously low that it's hard for regular people to put their money in bonds and expect to kind of live off interest. That's just not a, that used to be a, something people could do in the real world, and it's harder now.
So, Jonathan, you had mentioned that one of the enemies, if you will, that the Fed was fighting when they implemented these emergency measures was deflation. And when you look at the recent CPI numbers, I think in January they were negative. Now, obviously, fuel prices have a lot to do with that, if not exclusively. But do you see, in your view, that the risks of deflation are still looming?
I do. Mostly because we're scraping near zero. We, also in Europe and in Japan, at the inflation rate. And if it goes negative, that just it puts you in a very new and dangerous world. There can be self-defeating dynamics of falling prices with regard to the generation of economic activity and with regard to the practice of monetary policy. The costs, people hate inflation, and I appreciate that, and I understand why. But to the real economy, the aggregate costs of very modest levels of inflation, say 3%, even 4%, economists cannot show them. They cannot say 3.5% inflation has this negative consequence on the aggregate real economy. I understand it erodes individual people's purchasing power, but from the perspective of real economic growth overall, you cannot say 3.5% inflation is a bad thing. Anything under zero, we know, is a bad thing. and a dangerous thing for the economy and really can threaten economic growth. And so economic policymaking really needs to err on the side of a tiny bit more inflation than a tiny bit of negative inflation. And we are still in an environment where we're scraping too close to the risk of a deflationary environment. And we know for certain that is deleterious and it can kind of wind down the economy in bad ways. Just look at the experience of Japan for the past 20 years. And so the onus of policy really needs to lean in the opposite direction. And I know that this is a very politically charged topic and people, you know, shout hyperinflation from the rooftops. And it is certainly true that you cannot create economic activity by producing inflation. And that is not the point of the policy. The point of the policy is to make sure that monetary policy is not so restrictive that it's choking economic activity. So money cannot create action, and it will not. But the lack of money, too tight monetary policy, can be constricting of economic activity, and that can be dangerously consequential. So the question is, how do you orient your policy overall?
Jonathan, last question, the time we have left. With Europe now engaging in quantitative easing, with Japan having a very loose money policy, with the U.S. dollar now on a relative basis gaining significantly in strength, won't there be a lot of political pressure for the Fed to resume a quantitative easing program? And what do you think the Fed will do in light of that pressure?
I don't think so. My sense is that the weight of pressure on the Fed right now is more towards when will they peel back more of these quantitative easing measures? When will they start to raise interest rates? If you look at the minutes of the meetings of the Fed, the conversation seems to be tipping more in that direction. The main lever by which we will be negatively affected by the quantitative easing of others will be the exchange rate mechanism, the continued appreciation of the dollar. And if the Fed tightens money, the dollar will appreciate further still. In the U.S., because we have such a large domestic economy, that lever is not super direct. And so as the dollar appreciates, in the U.S. economy, dollar appreciation won't be super politicized. So I do think that it is possible that the quantitative easing of others and the general deflationary environment globally might take pressure off the Fed to act too promptly to back off quantitative easing and to raise interest rates aggressively. But I do think the tenor of the conversation, the thrust of political pressure that you see on the Fed in the current environment, is more towards get on with tightening. And it's not, I don't see the balance of pressure on the Fed towards loosening. That's, of course, I could be wrong, but I do think the struggle for the Fed will be resisting pressure to tighten too soon.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Professor Jonathan Kirshner. His book, American Power After the Financial Crisis, is something I would encourage you to check out and pick up. It's available at Amazon. And, Professor, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks. It's been a real pleasure.
Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. This is Everything Financial Radio. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Thanks to special guest this week, Mr. Jonathan Kirshner, for joining us. On Everything Financial Radio this week, we've been talking about the two-bucket approach. And it's an approach that we recommend that many folks take a look at and consider for managing their nest eggs. And we have been talking here on the Everything Financial Radio program about the difference between getting variable returns and fluctuating returns and more consistent returns. And, of course, any discussion we have when we talk about what's happened in the past needs to be premised or prefaced, I should say, with a statement that just because something happened in the past doesn't mean it's going to happen again in the future. Now, let's just take a look at this concept and, again, a little greater detail. Let's go back and look at the annual returns of the S&P 500 from calendar year 2000 through calendar year 2013. Now, speaking of average annual return, the average annual return of the S&P 500 over that time frame was 5.55%. Now, it's important to note that an investor cannot invest directly in the S&P 500. However, an investor can invest in a passively managed index fund that has the investment objective of duplicating the returns of the S&P 500. Now, just because a fund has that objective does not mean that that fund will actually achieve its objective. However, for this hypothetical discussion, let's assume you've got money in an index fund that's based on the S&P 500, and let's just assume the fund happens to return exactly what the S&P 500 index returns, as unlikely as that may be. Now, a $100,000 initial investment at the beginning of 2000 was worth, at the end of 2013, $163,961, and that's based on the average annual returns of the S&P 500, which ranged from a negative 37% in 2008 and a negative 22.1% in 2002 to as much as 32.39% return in 2013 and as much as 28.68% in 2003. So again, variable returns. Now let's contrast that with a 5.55% return every year on a consistent basis. A consistent return of 5.55% annually on a $100,000 beginning balance over the same time frame grows to $213,018. Comparing that to the average annual return of the S&P 500, which grew to only $163,961. So what's my point here? Well, given a choice between big potential for gains and consistency, many investors would be better served to seek consistency. This may become even more true for more investors as they get closer to needing to use the invested assets during retirement. Consistency is one of the five goals of the two-bucket management system. Now, if you're just tuning in, the five goals of the two-bucket management system, again, are to reduce fees associated with investments, limit or eliminate investment drawdown during a deflationary environment, limit losses, in other words, hedge for the possibility of inflation or even hyperinflation, hedge for the possibility of a future fiat currency failure, and achieve positive investment returns each year. And again, just because it's a goal of a particular strategy or methodology, that does not mean there's a guarantee the goal will be achieved. However, when you look at the two-bucket approach to managing assets, it's based in common sense, and it has a very simple premise. You just divide your assets into two separate buckets of money. Bucket number one is your deflation hedge bucket. It contains assets you'll need to meet your lifestyle needs during retirement. Bucket number two is your inflation hedge bucket. It should contain all your other assets. So in bucket number one, we're going to put assets that will tend to be more consistent, and in a deflationary environment, they will gain in purchasing power. Bucket number two is the bucket I'm going to rely on if we have significant inflation. And again, we can't predict policy response. Are we going to have inflation, or are we going to have inflation followed by deflation? Are we going to have go straight to deflation? The answer is yes, one of those will occur. Now the assets in bucket number one, which is the deflation bucket, should be invested conservatively, and the goal here is to achieve a predictable, consistent return. Now, assuming that outcome can be achieved, that approach will serve an investor well in a deflationary environment. A consistent, predictable return with no drawdown will gain purchasing power in a deflationary environment. Now, the assets in bucket number two should be invested to hedge against inflation, hyperinflation, or a fiat currency failure. We believe strict exit strategies should be used when managing bucket two assets in order to help protect from drawdown. And again, drawdown is what occurred in the stock market in 2001 and in 2008. It was a significant decline in the value of stocks. That's drawdown. Drawdown is defined as the price drop percentage from the peak to the trough. Avoiding drawdown is important and one of the big goals of bucket one assets. Now, the assets in bucket number one are paper money assets. The nice thing about paper money assets are that paper money assets gain purchasing power in a deflationary environment. When it comes to the assets in bucket number two, however, at least some of the assets should be real, tangible assets that are not the liability of another. This is a really important point. And a great question to ask yourself about your portfolio is, what assets do I have in my portfolio that are not the liability of someone else? See, the trouble, in my view, with the one-bucket approach advocated by many financial professionals using stocks and bonds or stock mutual funds and bond mutual funds only is that all the assets in the portfolio are paper assets. All these assets are the liability of another. And that brings me back to what I call an eternal economic truth. No central banker can change this truth. No politician can change this truth. Even with massive money printing, this truth cannot be changed. And here it is. If there's too much debt to be paid, not all the debt will be paid. It's as simple as that. If there's more debt than can be paid, then we know some of the debt will not be paid. It's that simple. And since we know there will be defaults on debt, which will result in a deflationary environment, it's important to ask ourselves this question. What assets in my portfolio are the liability of another? Or you could ask it another way, what assets in your portfolio are not the liability of another? Now, in my view, it's sad that in the case of many portfolios that I review, the answer is every asset in the portfolio is the liability of someone else. See, that's the nature of paper assets. See, while these assets are your assets, they're also the liability of another. When holding paper assets that are the liability of another, we want our counterparty to be as creditworthy as possible. Since we know not all the debt will be paid, but some of the debt will, if we're holding that debt or that paper asset in our portfolio, we want to be sure that we have a very high probability of getting repaid. Now, the reality is that the financial system under which we function uses paper assets that are the liability of another. So when it comes to selecting the assets in bucket number one, which are the assets you'll use during retirement, we have to use paper assets. We just want to make sure the counterparty, the person who owes us the money, the entity that owes us the money, the counterparty on these assets is creditworthy, so we minimize the risk of losing assets. Now, there are a number of different options for allocations in bucket number one and bucket number two, but it's important in our view that you understand the importance of using a two-bucket approach in light of these currency money cycles that exist and these economic cycles that exist. We talk about the two-bucket approach and allocation strategies in detail at our new retirement rules class. We give you some specific allocation recommendations you can use. When you leave the class, if you're comfortable with it and it fits your situation, you will be equipped to be able to implement these exact strategies in your portfolio, and you may not need any help to do it. So if you'd like to get more information about the New Retirement Rules class, I would invite you to visit the website, newretirementrules.com. You can register for the class there or get more information. Registration is available while capacity remains. Our next class will be held on April the 25th, which is a Saturday. It'll be held at the downtown campus of Western Michigan University. Parking is validated. It will cost you only $49 for the entire day, and that will include all the resources you'll leave the class with. So again, visit the website newretirementrules.com to get more information. It's amazing how quickly an hour goes by. That's our program for this week. Hope you got something you could use. Talk to you again soon.